Hello there, and welcome back to Peace in Their Time, episode 171, the 117 days before the first 100 days. For the past couple weeks, I've covered the life and times of good old FDR and his rise to the presidency at what would turn out to be the most critical point to the United States' history since the American Civil War. Today, we're picking back up with the main American narrative, which I last left off with back in episode 125. Herbert Hoover had just lost the 1932 presidential election, and the Republicans in Congress had been likewise disemboweled, which isn't a verb used often to describe election results, but that's what happened in this case. Not only did Roosevelt win in a landslide, the Democrats picked up 12 seats in the Senate to bring their total to 59 out of 100, while in the House of Representatives, they picked up 97 to bring their total there to 313 out of 435 total seats. The Democrats were set to enjoy unprecedented government control. But the election was in November, and this being the early 30s, the newly elected officials would only take office in March of 1933. The following lame duck period, as it's so-called in the U.S., is notable for a number of reasons, but the first was that it was the last to extend for an entire 4 months. Today it runs up to January 20th, but that was only changed with the 20th Amendment to the Constitution, which hypothetically would have only affected a presidential changeover in 1936-37 at the earliest. In practice, this was only applied with the election of Eisenhower in 1952 on account of FDR's unprecedented run of electoral success, followed by Harry Truman's own run of political luck. Anyway, why I'm talking about this is because unlike most lame duck periods, this one actually mattered, which might also mark the winter of 1932 to 1933 as one of the most significant on this show, as right at the same time as when the Weimar government in Germany was entering its terminal spasm of conspiracy that would elevate Hitler to power right before FDR entered the White House. And it was important for the U.S. because of action not taken, as Hoover's inaction sparked a new round of panic in the 117 days before the forthcoming first 100 days that would see a whirlwind of legislation get put on the books, hence my endearingly idiotic episode title. It was during those cold months that the banking system creaked to a shuddering halt. A new round of panic broke out, and gold and currency were hurriedly withdrawn, creating yet another disastrous round of bank runs. For the banks that didn't go under, their survival was predicated on shuttering their doors entirely, preventing any business at all from being conducted. Which, in a finance-based economy like the US's, that's apocalyptic. Nothing functions without banks extending credit. Which is even more true today, so don't look back on these guys as naive people from history who didn't know any better. It's just the reality of capitalism in general. Hoover attempted to pawn the crisis off on Roosevelt, suggesting they publicly work together, which FDR and his team correctly recognized as exactly what it was, an attempt to pass responsibility for the crisis onto the incoming administration. He had tried the same thing beforehand in December 1932 when he suggested a joint response to the question of European debts. Remember that at the end of 1932, the Locarno powers had all agreed to jointly suspend repayments on their debts to the U.S. on account of, well, you know, everything. Economic experts in the U.S. advocated canceling the debts and everybody moving on with their lives. But Congress and much of the U.S. public demanded those flighty Europeans make good on their debts, especially at a time when Americans really needed that money themselves. Hoover was angling to stick FDR with the job of canceling the debt. But Roosevelt saw through that ploy and opted to leave the issue alone. He wouldn't go after the Europeans too hard, but at the same time wouldn't cancel the debts. Hoover overstepped, though, in February 1933 when he sent a written letter, which was a solid 10 pages long, explaining to FDR that the Depression had been brought under control by summer 1932, and it was only Hoover's loss in the presidential election that had rebooted the panic they were now experiencing. Public confidence was lost because people and businesses were afraid of what government interference and overspending was going to do to the economy. he pointedly asked that FDR walk back on promises of interventionism in the economy and instead follow Hoover's example by keeping to a light touch and just enjoy the inevitable upswing. Hoover was basically asking for the New Deal platform to be abandoned before FDR had even taken office. Hoover really is one of my favorites from this era. He was so personally capable, but at the same time, so completely delusional. Part of why he actually thought that Roosevelt might listen to him was because he believed that Roosevelt was a shallow dullard who needed everything explained to him. Hoover, in their private meetings, likened the experience to working with a child. Which, just to provide my own take, I think that's how Hoover treated everyone who disagreed with him, so I don't think it was a specific thing to working with Roosevelt. He simply couldn't bring himself to consider that his approach had failed completely and utterly. The nation simply was not in a place to endure a continued light-touch response. There were 13 million people out of work, a solid 25% of the national workforce. Those who kept their jobs oftentimes had to endure pay cuts or reduced hours to avoid full unemployment. Deflation had set in on account of economic activity cratering, lowering prices, but only on account of there simply not being anybody with money on hand. The mortgages of farmers and the loans taken by businesses became financial death traps. The CPUSA, the American Communist Party, grew bold enough to march 1,200 people in front of Congress in December 1932 during its last session before the new administration took over. In the Midwest, farmers started getting together, forming not so much unions as they were, you know, just organized mobs threatening banks and officials trying to kick them off their land. Farmers might be naturally conservative, but try and foreclose on them all at once, well, that's a good way to get a rural uprising going. It was such that people back in D.C. started warning that they might have some serious trouble in the countryside if relief wasn't forthcoming. A senator from Pennsylvania in the summer of 1932 publicly declared that if the country ever needed a Mussolini, that was the time. Al Smith, FDR's old mentor turned political enemy, commented that the Constitution was expected to go on the shelf during wartime and that a dictatorship was to be expected in the circumstances. The nationally read columnist Walter Lippmann personally visited Roosevelt and told him point blank that there might be no alternative to him assuming dictatorial power. Going back to the bank shutdowns that paralyzed the economy, they really got going in February 1932 when it looked like Michigan's financial sector, the one that serviced Detroit and the auto industry, looked set to go under. The government wanted to step in using a loan from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, the RFC, that one big endeavor that Hoover had implemented in 1932 to directly loan money to failing banks to keep them from shutting down completely. The RFC guys approached Henry Ford about a collaboration, as his money was a big factor in keeping the lights on for Michigan banks. They asked him to defer the repayment of some money that the First National Bank of Detroit owed him, but he flatly refused. Moreover, if the RFC stepped in and imposed conditions restricting the bank from paying out to him, then he'd take all his money and go elsewhere, which would have caused a panic and collapsed the regional banking sector entirely. The RFC didn't have sufficient money available to stem a default among Michigan's major banks, so the government simply declared a holiday and shut them down. The country felt like it was unraveling, although you couldn't tell it from the languid activity coming from the outgoing administration. Where FDR and Hoover critically differed in how to respond was in how they defined the ongoing crisis. Hoover saw the whole thing as an international breakdown because people just couldn't follow the dang rules of the gold standard. He ignored that the U.S. was one of the main culprits of not following the rules by hoarding gold and failing to inflate its currency to correspond to that supply of gold, creating that feedback loop I described at the start of the season where most nations saw their money supply shrink. See episode 124 for a breakdown of that. To Hoover, the gold standard could not fail. It could only be failed. To fix it required an internationalist response with each nation cooperating on monetary policy, which, if you have been following along this season, you will know that was completely impossible, and you should be incredulous that Hoover could believe that it was possible in the depths of blind panic across the globe. The New Deal team believed that while the gold standard hadn't helped, the real root of the crisis was a runaway economy during the 1920s, meaning that it was all the domestic failures of the U.S. coming home to roost and not a global breakdown. There would be a partial reckoning with the gold standard, though reports of the system's demise would be greatly exaggerated, and more accurately, the Roosevelt administration would simply heavily modify it. The depression in the U.S. would be addressed as a domestic problem using domestic tools to fix it. Fixing Europe, inherently an impossible task short of war or revolution, would not be the panacea for the U.S. What was mildly concerning to everyone across the political spectrum was that FDR himself kept a rather sphinx-like disposition during the lame duck months. He held audiences with leading figures and heard their advice and requests, often humoring their input but refusing to commit to anything in particular. It was remarked upon how easily he brushed off people urging him to be a dictator with a chuckle and genial affability. Caesar, he was not. Huey Long recalled after a meeting that while Roosevelt had been agreeable to his suggestions about large-scale government intervention, he had also reportedly been agreeable with an earlier Republican guest from that day that had made the exact opposite suggestions. Like his polar opposite over in Germany that was coming into power at around the same time, Roosevelt was good at commanding a conversation, but the difference here was that he tricked people into thinking he wasn't controlling it. My favorite little anecdote I read about was a senator from Nevada trying to talk to him about a silver buying program from the government. Which made sense. Nevada produced a lot of silver, looking out for his interest there. And there was also the argument to be made that inflation was necessary in the economy, and to do that, silver had to be added to gold as a basis for the money supply. Good old Roosevelt, though, regaled him with a story from his youth when he dug around for silver in Campobello while on holiday. The story lasted for an hour and a half. They didn't actually talk about the silver program at all. I like to think that I would be infuriated at the colossal waste of time at such conversations, but I've never been exposed to the FDR charm. He spoke far more directly and definitively on the issue of farm relief and urban unemployment, calling those his top priorities, and that he would be supportive of labor unions and their efforts to empower the nation's workers. National infrastructure would be overhauled, which included the nationalization of public utilities where it was felt needed. The days of individual projects set up here or there would be outdone by region-wide, ongoing national projects. There would be action, everyone was sure about that. But then he would turn around and talk about balancing the budget, which to everyone ready to go to economic war knew was insane. Raising some taxes was fine and dandy, but it wasn't going to pay for getting out of the pit they were in. One congressman pointed out that if tens of billions could be spent on war, surely a lesser amount could be afforded to getting people out of poverty. Roosevelt assured everyone during the campaign and the lame duck months that people could expect the financial titans to be shown the door in terms of setting policy. Because amidst a national despair, the business community kept advocating for a continuation of Hoover's discredited policies, which went a great way towards turning the people against them. The conservative approach to governing was impossible to be continued in the eyes of the body public, and businessmen going before Congress to advocate that it should just keep on going only resulted in they themselves becoming discredited. Whatever FDR was planning, what constituted his opposition had nothing to sell people in opposition to him. His rhetoric certainly was not that of the 1920s. He declared that the task ahead was not searching for and exploiting new resources, and breathtakingly bold for an American president, he went so far as to say that the end goal was not necessarily restoring the dizzying production of goods seen in the previous decade. Conspicuous consumption was not going to be the priority. They weren't going to artificially grow the economy out of crisis the way modern American administrations have always sought. Recovery would come about by adjusting the existing economy so that it better served everyone in a steady manner, insulated from catastrophic bubbles. There would be an economic declaration of rights where the focus would be on getting common people back on their feet and enjoying a comfortable, but not excessive, living. By the time he actually took office in March 1933, the national mood had grown pessimistic, and the earlier post-election enthusiasm had died down considerably. there was an uptick in public confidence after mid-February when FDR survived an assassination attempt. So, little sidebar on that. Giuseppe Zangara, an Italian-American bricklayer, opened fire on Roosevelt during a speech he was giving from a parked car in Chicago. The circumstances for Zangara were not ideal. He was armed with a revolver and stood 25 feet away from his intended target. Between him was a crush of people, which was bad for the 5-foot-tall assailant. The guy had to stand on a metal folding chair, one of those crappy ones that wobbled a lot. He got one shot off before people grabbed him, causing him to fire again wildly several more times. 5 people suffered injury, and he managed to fatally wound the mayor of Chicago, who died almost 3 weeks later. These types of things are always shocks, and people rallied around the incoming president, who had almost been taken from them. I can only imagine what the world would have been like if the attempt had succeeded. Zangara was said by many to be mentally ill, though it did him little good. He was tried immediately and executed on March 20th, only a little over a month after his attack. The incident consolidated the image of FDR as being a man steady under pressure, as during the incident, he immediately had the grievously injured mayor loaded into his car and shipped to a hospital. His speechwriter and advisor, Raymond Moley, was with him during the incident and recalled watching FDR holding the dying mayor in his arms during the car ride. Roosevelt and Moley shared drinks that evening, and the speechwriter was struck by the lack of concern over being missed by a bullet by mere inches. FDR kept up his genial countenance and acted as though the day's events were all humdrum. Dramatic as the incident was, FDR was otherwise occupied with the more mundane task of picking out his cabinet, which, just to make the comparison again from earlier in the episode, would be among the most consequential picks since Lincoln's during the days of the Civil War. For Secretary of State, not exactly the most important position at the time, but would see a lot of activity as the years of this podcast would go on, Roosevelt picked a senator from Tennessee, Cordell Hull. In doing so, he rejected past figures from the Wilson administration and selected someone unbeholden to other factions in the Democratic Party. The message was that FDR's team would be his first and foremost. There was a little bit of scoffing, as Hull might have risen through the political ranks, but he didn't exactly have a diplomat's resume. Low expectations would be exceeded, though, and Hull would become a key lieutenant, which in turn would make him the longest-serving Secretary of State ever at 11 years, only resigning at the end of 1944. At the Treasury Department, FDR initially selected an old occupant of that office in Carter Glass, who had been secretary during the Wilson years. Glass talked himself out of a job by dropping the ultimatum that there would be no deficit spending on his watch, which, that didn't go over too well. The nod instead went to William Wooten, a Republican businessman in ill health, but also one who saw which way the winds were blowing and advocated decisive action, supporting FDR even during the election. He provided insight into the business world that FDR appreciated, while at the same time supported reform of that world. To Roosevelt, he was a steady hand during the first months of his administration. He also lent some, well, if not cooperation, then some impassiveness from the business class as they recognized Wooten as one of their own. I'm going to get a little ahead of myself and let you all know he didn't last too long, although this was a case of poor health forcing him to resign at the very end of 1933 and not a result of conflicts with his boss. His replacement, Henry Morgenthau, was, like Hull, going to be a longtime hand of the administration. He served from the start of 1934 all the way to July 1945 and was going to be a key guy in actually executing the New Deal. The Secretary of the Interior, which oversaw the management of federal lands and ergo was going to be a big part of development projects, including the upcoming Public Works Administration, fell to Harold Ickes. Again, he would be an old hand, remaining at his post until February 1946. The Secretary of Agriculture spot went to Henry Wallace, a name you might already be familiar with as he is one of the heroes of the Democratic Party's left wing. He was one of the most active and brilliant members of FDR's cabinet, and as such regarded as the greatest leader the Department of Agriculture has ever seen. Along with his deputy, Rexford Tugwell, he represented the leading part of the Brain Trust that also included Ickes and numerous other figures who formed the inner circle responsible for the New Deal. Wallace would eventually leave his secretaryship in 1940 to become vice president. He would fall victim to the Democratic Party's swing to the right after FDR's death, and unfortunately never reached the highest office he was qualified for. Rexford Tugwell, which is as fake a name as I've ever heard, was no slouch either. Young, brilliant, and by a decent margin the most radical of the inner circle, he wasn't afforded high places in the administration, and his radicalism earned him outside criticism that led to his departure from the administration in 1936. As we'll get deeper into the New Deal history, remember, he is the guy who was most willing to push government power to the limits that a conservative America would allow. The last person I'll mention is the Secretary of Labor, which went to Frances Perkins. Hers is a name you should know by now, and whom you should remember, as she was the first female member of the cabinet, serving to June 1945. Her ongoing role all through those years was in implementing workplace reforms and engaging with the growing union movement, with her most notable single contribution being undoubtedly putting together the Social Security program that to this day remains the most notable example of public welfare in the United States. Obviously, there are other positions with other faces and names, and they'll come up here and there. These guys, though, based on both talent and longevity, were going to be the most influential during the Roosevelt years. I mean, most all of them served either over 12 years or close to it. America has never experienced that level of consistency in its highest offices. And it's really handy for my purposes, as they'll be names that are going to stick with us for the duration of this show. Get used to them, they aren't going anywhere. The response from pundits and politicians was one of apprehension to this list, mostly on account of the names selected not really being the most notable establishment types. While all were capable and came from, you know, elite backgrounds or elite-ish backgrounds, they weren't the movers and shakers of D.C. Some of them, like Wallace and Ickes, were looked at with apprehension on account of their radical stances. Regardless of foreboding, the changeover in power went ahead on March 4, 1933. FDR began his day in the late morning at a religious service with his family, some friends, and his cabinet. In defiance of the grim national atmosphere, a celebration parade was held around the Capitol building to mark the occasion and await FDR's swearing in. Tugwell noted that despite fears of the national mood being too dour, that people turned out in droves anyway to witness the festive parade composed of marching bands and drill groups. Perkins noted the scared looks of many as whispers swirled that the last of the country's banks had shut down. There was conjecture on if they would ever again reopen. Roosevelt himself had gone to the White House after the service to follow the tradition of traveling to the Capitol building with the outgoing president. Roosevelt tried to make conversation, but Hoover, finally relieved of his duties, shot down any attempt at small talk with a simple grunt. FDR quickly dropped the attempt and focused on waving his hat and smiling at the crowd from the open-air car conveying them. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court Charles Evans Hughes was on hand to swear Roosevelt in. As Chief Justice, he'd find his public career's final act in resisting the New Deal, but for now it was all formalities. Immediately after the swearing-in, Hoover beat a hasty retreat, opting not to stick around for the president's speech. He would spend the rest of his life trying to rewrite history in an effort to salvage his reputation. Not a lot of good it did him, as he'd always be the guy who was too smart for his own good. The snub didn't matter one bit either. FDR delivered an all-timer of an inaugural speech, declaring that for the people of the U.S., the only thing they had to fear was fear itself. The substance focused on getting people back to work, and that the business class had abandoned their positions of authority in the public space. The government would have a free hand to fix what the private side had broken so badly. The speech went over like a lightning bolt, energizing Americans in the moment of their greatest despair. Perkins likened the live reaction to the speech as akin to a church service, a sudden moment of affirmation as people opened themselves up to the hope that circumstances could turn around, that they could get better again. It was also a positive speech in its outlook. There was little fear-mongering. It was a straightforward call to action. The challenges ahead were grave indeed, but they were not insurmountable. As a community working together, they could be overcome. The people had not heard such things in over 15 years. It was the classical juxtaposition of right versus left. The right obsesses over what cannot be done, the left with what can be done. The speechwriter, Raymond Moley, had tinkered with the speech on and off again for 5 months, and he had outdone himself. Secretary of the Treasury Wooten, for his part, did not have an idle inauguration day. He had begun the day in the early morning at the Treasury Department, not yet sworn in, working with the outgoing Secretary Ogden Mills. They and their mutual staffs agreed that morning to present a plan before FDR to act on an interpretation of the Trading with the Enemy Act to formalize a shutdown of the banking sector, convene an emergency session of Congress, and to set up a meeting on the very next day of prominent East Coast bankers to provide them their marching orders. FDR, during his short get-together with his cabinet during the church service that morning, agreed to the plan. The applicability of the Trading with the Enemy Act was itself ingenious and a good example of state power being applied in ways the original creators in no way intended. The act was approved during World War I to prevent businesses from trading and financing the Central Powers. It had, in the interim, been partially repealed, but on paper it left the president with the theoretical power of restricting the movement of gold and money. In the days before the inauguration, Ogden Mills and his people had informed Wooten and Tugwell that not only was this a course of action that had been debated, but plans were in place to execute them immediately. It was primarily the stubbornness of Hoover that had prevented that. Moreover, Mills advised that the law, properly interpreted, of course, also allowed for the banking sector to be shut down completely. After all, how could the movement of money be restricted if banks weren't restricted as well? The point of the plan was to shut down the flight of gold out of banks and out of the country, which would paralyze the financial system, but at least keep it alive. Think of it as inducing a coma into a patient so that damage couldn't progress further. But for them, that would all be for tomorrow. Or for us, it'll all be for next week. It would be a busy start to an administration by any standard, and even earned a catchy name, the first 100 days, a nice round number. This period of time does get built up in the myth of the New Deal, and the reality is that it took a lot more in order to restore the U.S.'s fortunes. But activity during that brief window did set the pace of what was to be done, and demonstrated to a public used to crippling inaction that things would be different. Much different, in fact. The work went a long way to restoring confidence and just getting things going again. As the old proverb says, a thousand-mile journey begins with a single step. Join me next week as we get the journey of the New Deal properly started, and as always, thank you very much for listening.